Well, joining me in the studio now is one of the people who is very responsible for the growing movement of aging Americans who are insisting on their right to lead full, rewarding, and healthy lives. My guest is Maggie Kuhn, the founder and the present convener of the Grey Panthers, a national group dedicated to undoing stereotyping and discrimination against older Americans. The group was founded in 1970 when Maggie and five friends, all retiring from religious and social work organizations, came together to discuss common problems which face retirees. Major issues that have been since addressed by the Grey Panthers include elimination of mandatory retirement laws and accessible, affordable health care for all aging Americans. Maggie, by the way, is now 73, going on 74. Also joining us in the studio is Dr. John Fryer, who is presently an associate professor of psychiatry at Temple University School of Medicine, where he is also an associate professor of family practice and community health. Welcome to Fresh Air. It's a really great pleasure to be able to welcome you here this afternoon. Maggie, let me start with what is probably the obvious. Why is healthcare such the high priority that it is for the Grey Panther Group?
The Grey Panthers are a coalition of young people and old people. People assume, as you did, that we're simply old. But we're saying that oldness is the thing that we share with all people of all ages. And health is a universal need, a universal right, and particularly important to older Americans who are living longer than any other group in recorded history have lived. I think there's one statistic that is very interesting to look at. Every day in the United States, 5,000 people turn 65. And every day in the United States, 3,600 people over 65 die, leaving a net gain of 1,400 people who stay alive and who have to be as well as they can possibly be and hopefully productive and useful members of the community. So health is a priority to maintain wellness and maximum productivity and usefulness, and also to help us to work in a constructive way with the young and with the middle aged, so that we can put into practice today what we know through experience.
Dr. Fryer, what has your involvement been with the Grey Panthers?
Well, I've been involved peripherally with Maggie for several years. We both live in Germantown, both concerned about the health status of the community of Germantown as well as the people of Germantown. And I can always depend on Maggie to come down and talk to the medical students to help to educate them about people generally as well as about old people. My particular interest then is in part with the Grey Panthers. Its larger interest, though, is the fact that I tend to carry in my practice and tend to be involved with the kinds of things that are happening to old people. I tend to see a lot of old patients, and a lot of times we'll work with younger members of the family and suddenly find that the problem, quote-unquote problem, is really an older member of the family that they haven't really been able to work with or that around whom a problem has developed.
You see, one of the reasons why I just have such a warm affection for Dr. Fryer is because he looks at us in a holistic way. He sees the family as a whole. He sees the community, the living situation in which people grow up and grow old as part of their lives. And I think that that's one of the new concepts in health maintenance that he and other leaders in the field are attempting. And we'd like to support and commend that and to help our members to understand that this is something new that is being developed. Many of us have had very, not myself personally, because I've been the recipient of very good care, but in many ways I'm privileged, but my peers have not been so fortunate. There are many doctors who are not very much interested, as Dr. Fryer is, in the well-being and of old people who give them the brush off and say, "Well, what do you expect at your age? You know, you're old." Well, now that's a terrible put down for people who are trying to make it.
I think a lot of people look back kind of nostalgically to the time when there were lots of doctors who, if you got sick, would hop in their car and come over and see you, examine you, prescribe stuff if necessary, treat you, and then drive away to their next house call. And there aren't many doctors who make house calls anymore, I think. And I'd imagine that that's a particularly difficult situation for people who are old and who are going to have more difficulty hopping into their car in the middle of the night if they get really
sick. Or who may not have a car.
May not have a car. And Lord knows in this city there isn't much public transportation in the middle of the night, even if you felt safe enough to run out and take it or felt well enough to run out and take it.
Except that there have been some recent studies done in healthcare by people who are researching healthcare to show that home visits are really a very economical and very good way to render health care, primary health care, and appropriate way in many instances. And I think if we're dealing with a life-threatening situation, certainly the devices are present in a hospital emergency room, which is not present in a home. But if we're talking about day-to-day primary care situation, more and more it's becoming apparent that that can be done economically. And that the real issue is to build on a system of using primary health care providers other than physicians and physicians in a way of sequencing home visits in a planned way, which can be equally as inexpensive as the other kind of care. Now, at present, that kind of thing is difficult to get paid for by third-party payers. There are all sorts of blocks. Medical students never learn how to make a home visit, and they're never going to do something they never learned how to do. They never learned how to
take... doctors used to get taught how to do a home visit?
Got taught by watching other doctors do it.
Uh-huh.
By going along on the visits. And now that doesn't happen. And I can imagine in my own mind, I tend to be a bit of an idealist, I'm afraid, but I can imagine doctors back in the 1890s getting in their horse and buggy and the young medical student or the trainee going with them, and the doctor saying, "Now you take your galoshes off and you put it over here and you don't speak to this one and you do speak to that one." And going to the whole process of how you do that. Well, we don't teach our medical students social graces. A young medical student, and this gets at the whole issue we're talking about, a young medical student friend of mine has, and his work as a medical student the last few weeks, gotten to know the patients, gone to their home, and visited them, become their advocate, because this medical student has been taught by me that that's his role as a physician. And his attendings and his residents and his intern all look on him with disdain and say that he's not behaving appropriately. And he is really almost forced into a position where when he talks about an old person, he's to use the various euphemistic negative names that they use. Or he's not one of them.
Like what?
Well, I'm not sure I really want to get into their really
negative, yeah.
extremely negative kind of names that are used by people who are concerned entirely with the technology of medicine and transmitting that technology and doing a superb job of that. But they're not transmitting attitudes, they're not transmitting the technology of making home visits and of being patient advocate.
When you started talking about this, you mentioned people other than doctors going out and making some of these house calls. With what kind of training are you suggesting?
Particularly, I'm referring to physician's assistants. I'm referring to family nurse practitioners,
mm-hmm.
people who are nurses or who are physician's assistants with special training in going out into homes can render primary care, which is triage, meaning I walk in the home and I look at what's going on with this person and I decide what needs to be done. Does a doctor need to be here? Does this person need to go to an emergency room? Does this person need immediate care? Or is there something that I can do? And usually they are given certain license to do certain things. But they're expert at that. Many of them were trained in Vietnam and in the service where they had to triage. People's lives depended on their triage ability. Now, medical doctors often are not good at triage at all. Because most medical physicians are good at one little thing, which they do very well, and they try their darndest to get the person to fit into that little thing. However they can.
Well, you know, I like your approach so much, and it seems to me so human and so doable. The fact is, I don't really believe that a physician can make a good diagnosis and develop a complete holistic plan for that person's maintenance without seeing the living situation. What kind of a place is this that person call home? And I've known, in fact, we have some horrible examples in our files of people who have been sent home from acute care hospitals to situations that are going to predispose them to accidents and to further illness. And nobody in that hospital has ever seen the living situation to which they are discharged. And that, to me, seems absolutely wrong.
I always figured that one of the reasons why most doctors don't really make house calls now is that they could fit more people in, schedule people tighter if the people come to their office. It also cuts out a step for them. The first time I had to, you know, go with the flu to a doctor, I said, oh, wait a minute, I thought I'm not supposed to go outside. You know, I have a temperature. I was so appalled. I was used to being a child and having my, you know, my pediatrician come and visit me, and my mother, you know, would never let me outside with a sickness, you know.
Certainly it's more efficient for the doctor to see a number of patients in his office. He doesn't learn as much about the patient in his office. So it's I think probably most healthcare provider teachers these days are saying certainly 80% of the visits should be in the office or in the hospital or wherever, mm-hmm. the clinic. But that occasionally there need to be home visits. Now, there on the other hand, if we're dealing with a situation in which a person has a terminal illness, has been sent home, or has in some way incapacitated so they can't get out, then I think it's appropriate the doctor make all the visits at home, mm-hmm. rather than carting the patient into an ambulance every time it turns around. Really, the doctor can really evaluate what the situation is much better.
And the expense of ambulance service and all of that added on to the cost of the actual care.
And although the cost is saved for the physician, it seems to me the total cost to society is greater, if not greater.
So you're suggesting the physician could even charge more and it would come out to be less than what someone would have to pay with an ambulance.
That's
and
right.
then a doctor.
In terms of the society, would have to pay.
Yeah. Well, the General Accounting Office of the federal government made an in-depth study that covered several months that determined that that home health care and maintenance was cost-effective, quote-unquote, and that there ought to be speedily enacted measures and laws and regulations that would support that system. But we have to play a catch-up now because you don't have, as you say, Dr. Fryer, we don't have yet the medical personnel that have been conditioned and trained to deliver service on that basis.
If you're just joining us, I have two guests in the studio, Maggie Kuhn, the founder and convener of the Gray Panthers, and also Dr. John Fryer, who is on the faculty of Temple University. Maggie, you use an expression called healthy blocks, and I think this will probably fit into the concept of, you know, being able to be treated in your neighborhood or in your home. Can you describe this healthy block concept to us?
Well, we did a small feasibility study in a section of Germantown several years ago by a graduate student from University from Bryn Mawr in School of Social Work, and we discovered that there were people in that particular area, which included, I think, two square blocks. There were people who were the natural leaders, who were concerned about their neighborhood and who had lived there a long time. Now, some of those were older people. They, along with a number of old people who lived at that time in a congregate home, constituted a risky group. You know, they were subject to things that might make them quite ill or incapacitated from some accident. So we said that a healthy block had three goals. A more or less continuing assessment of the health status of all the people and that whole environment. Is it a healthy place in which to live? and that the Healthy Block concept would bring together physical, mental, and environmental health in one consideration and in one package. And the health providers who would come in would not be specialists, you know, looking at a particular part of the health system or the particular part of the body, but would have a holistic approach. We also thought that there were certain natural leaders who could be identified in the area, who could be given some minimal training in first aid, in recognizing early warning signals of sickness, who could be watching out for deterioration in the buildings and, you know, the general condition of the neighborhood, whom we called health builders. And then the design also included, this was part of our feasibility study, a team of health service providers who would come in upon the early warning signaling of the health builders to work on whatever needed to be changed. But the neighborhood as a whole would have a part of maintaining our good health.
So would this make it possible, for instance, for someone to, if they felt like they were about to be suffering from something, would it make it possible for them to call a neighbor, or just, like, you know, ring a buzzer or something,
yeah,
or someone next door, and then they'd know what to do and who to call,
and they would be they would have a continuing contact with the health team. And the health team would be backed up by whatever medical facilities are needed.
I think there's another extension to this, Maggie, too. I think Maggie talks about the fact that maybe a person is not able to shovel their walk, and people are liable to fall on that place of the block. So the neighbors who are able to shovel the block would shovel it, while the woman or man who is stuck at home might be able to take care of the children or the person who's shoveling, so that there are trade-offs back and forth, not only around health care, but Healthy Block in a larger sense in terms of the environment. I'd like to add one thing to also what Maggie's saying, that some of us in Germantown, and those of you who are listening who are from Germantown and are interested, some of us are putting together a holistic health center in Germantown under the sponsorship of the Wissick and Deanery of the Episcopal Church, and this is going to be on the model of the Holistic Health Center in Chicago, started by Granger Westberg. And a fair amount of money and energy has already been invested and is being sought for something that will be just north of central Germantown and will be a center which will focus not only on physical health, primary care physical health, but also mental health and spiritual health and environmental health. And we'll have workshops, and this is just getting off the ground, and people can call me and get information about that.
Well, that sounds very exciting. Would you be interested in giving your phone number?
Oh, yes. You can call me at Victor 8-2806. That's 848-2806 in Germantown. Just leave word on my answering service if I'm not there.
Dr. Fryer and I are very excited about this idea and the Good Health Center and the Healthy Block surrounding that area could be a very, very important model for a new kind of health care that could be replicated in other parts of the greater Delaware Valley and certainly in other major cities.
Maggie, you recently returned from a trip to China. Did you see any aspects of their health care system that felt supportive to you as far as the directions you're thinking in now?
Well, I was very much impressed, and all of the members of our study group were likewise. There were 24 of us who went last August to look at the status and role of old people in the People's Republic of China. We were impressed with the way in which the health system included the paraprofessionals, the barefoot doctors, the health orderlies, the persons that you're talking about, you know, that you're building into the new system that you're devising. We have an excellent model. It works very well in the People's Republic of China and in the countryside, out in rural areas where there are scattered, you know, small settlements, as well as in the big cities. Shanghai is the largest city in the world, and it has a network of neighborhood health groups. Now, the old people in those neighborhood organizing efforts, the neighborhood committees, are very, very crucial because they know everybody. They've lived there for a long time. They're the trusted elder persons whom people will turn to, so that they have not only a very useful part of that system, but they also are affirming in a new way the role of the responsible elder. Not the wrinkled baby old person,
right.
but the responsible elder who is concerned about the survival of the group, the neighborhood, the young. It's a beautiful model to follow.
There are many Americans now who are, say, in their 40s, 50s, who have parents now who are in their 60s, their 70s, who are coming to terms with the amount of responsibility that they feel they should take for the health of their parents. And that that means making a lot of decisions. Should they not ever leave far from home, in case, this is if they don't live together, and or even if they do, excuse me, should they not travel far in case one of their parents gets sick in the middle of the night and needs emergency health care and would have difficulty taking care of themselves in a situation like that? Should they perhaps consider sending their parent or parents to a nursing home so that they have care all the time, but that does mean taking them out of their environment. I'd be interested in some of the experiences that you've had with people related to these issues.
I think that I like a term which is either assisted autonomy or enabled autonomy, which means that my firm belief is that even the craziest, even the sickest, even the youngest, or even the oldest person has every right to define what kind of health care they want, and to define how they want to live, and to define their own health goals, and if they want to be fat, if they want to smoke, if they want to kill themselves in one or another way, they really have that right once they have had the issue defined for them. And given that kind of belief system, I really feel that a child's role with a parent is a kind of watchful concern. The word that we use that is used in Al-Anon, which is the group of family members of alcoholics who are in AA. Al-Anon groups refer to loving detachment with regard to how they manage an alcoholic person. And I think that name, again, is appropriate. Providing loving attachment or assisted autonomy, saying your life, your choices are your own. Once you make them, I will help you do what it is you need to get done. I think that there are a lot of people in my age group, in the 40s, with parents in Maggie's age group. Maggie is one of my surrogate mothers. with parents in this age group who feel they must hover over that relative, make all the decisions for that relative. And since that relative made all the decisions for them when they were young, it becomes a very easy, what we call, vertical relationship that simply reproduces that thing, which is healthy neither for the young person nor for the old. So what all that comes down to is that the older person should be given choices, should be offered opportunities, should be asked what they want, and then enabled to get that. Now, some of the tricks that I've found useful in working with the number of old people that I have, the first trick is to do something that Maggie suggested to me, which is to demythologize old age. I think all of us believe that when we get old, we're not going to think right. We're not going to be able to be a sexual creature. We think we're not going to be able to eat our food the same way, and we're not going to think appropriately. We're going to be a little crazy. And I find that I use the good offices of being a physician to say to these people that none of that has to happen. And I think that's something physicians can do, but it's also something that all of us need to do for the people in the 40s and the 20s who are going to be coming along and getting older. So first trick is demythologize age. A second very particular trick is to, when the family has chosen to take the responsibility for an older person, and that older person is incapacitated to some extent, that the family be encouraged to give themselves vacations for a month, once or twice a year. And that can be worked out with some of the homes in the Philadelphia area. I know there's one out in the Mainline area that will take people in for a month while the family gets a vacation, even though they just stay at home. They have a vacation from that task so that they don't feel that responsibility over and over again. The third thing that I think is important for old people, but also for all people, is to make sure that whatever information is given is clear, honest, and accurate. That when I, as a physician, any physician tells the patient what's going on with them, that they give totally accurate information, and that they develop a tradition of honesty in their relationships. Many times, physicians or other health care givers don't really intend to lie, but do, by not saying things or by talking in words that people don't understand. And a lot of times, physicians and other health care providers do that mainly because of their own uncertainty, their own immaturity, or their own fear that the patient, the older person, can't accept it. And so it's important for the young person, the 40-year-old person with their parent or the 20-year-old with a grandparent, to make sure that the information is accurate, to enable the person to make his or her own choices, and then, having made their choices, support the choices.
Maggie, let me ask you about yourself and some of your peers, and how you wish to be handled, and how you your friends have been or wish that they are treated by their children, if they have them, in terms of that, you know, relationship of responsibility, or what's the word that you use? Detached, loving detachment.
Loving detachment, yeah.
Do you have a sense of the balance that many of your peers, Maggie, would like to have with their children, again, if they have children?
I remember it was a great day in my life when my mother and I discovered that we were friends. And we avoided, in her later years, the mistake that I've seen other adult children make with their older parents, of treating them like babies. And the role reversal, you know, they become the parent of a dependent wrinkled baby. Now, I think that there has to be some new understanding between adult children and their parents, that they're friends, and that the autonomy that Dr. Fryer describes is respected on both parts. But it seems to me that the family, which is by and large a nuclear family, you know, just it might be a single person. Very often, the caregiver who in middle life is a woman, a daughter or a daughter-in-law who assumes the responsibility of the care of older parents, and this is a very heavy burden without the vacation period away from that demand and. But also without some kind of support from the community. Now, some of that support could come from established agencies, health community nurses, visiting nurses, therapists who come to the house. But we don't yet have a coherent delivery that brings those people together. Each one requires a separate doctor's order in order to have any kind of reimbursement under our present paying system through insurance, medical insurance of various kinds. And there is not any consistent kind of support that an anxious and stressed adult can count on. So the you're forced into some kind of institutional arrangement, which nobody wants.
Has that been your experience with people who you know who've
begun to live in
nursing home?
And we've had letters. I've had letters come to the house. Distressed people who say, "I've called everybody. I need somebody to come and help me with my mother just a few hours, a week or a day, and I can't find anybody who will do that." So that we've got to look for some entirely new kinds of help and new jobs. But beyond that, I think the long-range view is to look at the family in new terms. And this is what the Grey Panthers have been doing. We have been talking and demonstrating in our own lives to some in the beginning stages of a demonstration, that the family may not have to depend, that it can be a family of choice, that you can put together a group of people who have a common interest and a common need that are not blood related or tied from any legal point of view. And I like the definition that the American Home Economists Association devised a couple years ago. They said that the family unit is two or more persons who share lifestyles, resources, goals, and commitment to decision-making over time. And that this relationship is transcending blood and legal ties, adoption, and marriage. Now, that allows for a wide choice. Now, I have three young housemates who live with me, who rent space in my house, which is much too big for me to live in alone, which I couldn't afford. But we have a community of interest and a community of concern that is supportive for me, and I like to think that it's meaningful in all of our lives.
Now,
any
number
of people could do that. You see, in every community and in every worshiping congregation in temples and churches, there are old women, widows for the most part, or single women, who have big old houses. And those houses could be shared, but we have made a fetish of, you know, independence, and I think that's not appropriate in old age. There has to be a new kind of interdependence, and there are young people who need space.
I find the could be great. Living relationship that you're describing, Maggie, really exciting, because I think a lot of people feel or have felt that, well, you know, it's one thing for, you know, young people to feel this interdependence and to have a kind of family relationship that's not based on law or blood. But these things fall to pieces really quickly. And, you know, when you're older, it's only your family who will be there. And that's kind of a byword of a lot of people. When you're older, it's only your family that will be there.
But, you know, and this is the common view. But in my instance, for instance, I have outlived all of my relatives except second cousins that live far away. Now, what's my family, you see?
I know that I count as one of the joys in my life in the last 10 years, having had a close personal friendship with Margaret Mead. And when she came to visit me in my big old German townhouse, where I live with my dog at that time, she said, who's a very wise human being, but he's really a dog. She said, you need another set of human beings in this house. And really, the only healthy arrangement will be when you have an old person living with you and then have people in the middle generation living with you. And this business of, and she said very clearly that having people all of one generation in the house, putting all the old people together, all the young people together, is really an intrinsically unhealthy kind of thing. It really makes for a lot of problems that having one person outside that generation living there can help solve very quickly.
I wonder how many people have people who are close to them outside of their blood family, and they might not even live in the same state at this point, but who have people who they would count as friends who are in different generations.
It's, I don't know how many, but I can certainly say the number probably is still becoming smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Because more and more people are cherishing their autonomy in their own little place. And what's the term you use, Maggie, to describe the leisure...
Glorified playpens,
yes, where old people go together. And again, that is born out of their fear that they will become physically sick and there will be no one to take care of them. So if they go where there are lots of other old people and nurses and doctors, there will be people to take care of them. But in the glorified playpens, the ones I have visited, I really wonder about the quality of life. And I think those are issues. Now, certain people want that and strive to get it. I remember several years ago I visited Grand Canyon, and I went to the restaurant, the Fred Harvey restaurant that looks out over the canyon. And I was by 40 years the youngest person in the room. And everybody else were people who had saved up their money to retire, to take the Ameripass tour into the Grand Canyon, and they were looking at it. And you were thinking how wonderful that they saw it, but how wonderful it would have been if they'd seen it earlier. Or maybe if on that tour there had been some college students who wanted to go along. What happens when you mix that up? And we're, I think, a unique culture in that, and I think we'll have to pay for that at some point, because most cultures have mixed the generations.
I think that there we have to put a big fat question mark against the current trend toward age-segregated housing and age-segregated arrangements for all. We've chopped up the continuum of life into little pieces and kept each piece separate and made it a traumatic, shocking thing to move from one, you know, transitional stage to another. I just feel that that the mix is the healthy way to live and the way to maintain a quality of life for all concerned. And this means changing most of the federal policies. It certainly means reassessing the priorities that HUD has given to subsidizing houses. The only money that they put into publicly assisted housing today is housing for senior citizens, senior high-rises that continue the age segregation and that escalate the fear of old people by the young and the distrust and hostility that old people feel about young people and how terrible it is for both groups.
I think there's a less institutionalized way that's also continued, and that's the distrust just a lot of people who rent their homes have for any group of people who want to live together that aren't legally bound, that aren't formally family, and whether that's a man and a woman who want to live together who aren't married, or a group of two or three or four or five people of one generation or different generations who want to live together and who aren't bound by blood. It's going to be really difficult in many places to find a place where you don't have to make up all kinds of ridiculous lies.
You see, we've got to change. We've got to change the housing and zoning laws of America in order to live in a human way.
Let me just remind everyone who's just tuning in now that my guests are Maggie Kuhn and Dr. John Fryer. And Maggie Kuhn is the founder and convener of the Gray Panthers, and John Fryer is an associate professor of psychiatry at Temple University School of Medicine, where he's also an associate professor of family practice and community health. We were talking a little bit about nursing homes, and I think the situation really changes when you're trying to decide what's best for someone if that person is suffering with a terminal illness and if the length of their remaining life is kind of short and if they need intensive care, or if doctors have suggested they have intensive care for that remaining interval.
I think that this gets me to something I guess I really wanted to get to today while we're talking. I've been involved over the last couple of weeks with a case of a young man with leukemia, and on whom a lot of measures were being attempted to try to produce a remission, but it was fairly clear by day before yesterday, that the various measures were not working, and he was becoming progressively and rapidly more and more sick. And we began to work with the family. I've been seeing them really for about a month or two. Began to work with the family in terms of a lot of their feelings about it. And the decision was then made night before last by the young man to stop the various treatment measures that were going on, that he was really tired. He did not want to fight any longer. And very fortunately, a doctor yesterday morning heard this, and before anybody had a chance to give it the kind of thought one gives and then changes one's mind, he stopped the various treatments. So I got a sort of panic call then from somebody else, another doctor, saying, please come over here. All the doctors are up in the air. So I went over and began treating the doctors, each one of whom had a notion of how this young man should die. And what I finally said to each of them was, you are not God. You don't know how this person will really die. Why don't you let him make the decisions about his care? About halfway through this process, I began to realize that what really needed to happen was this young man needed to go home. That's what he really wanted to do. He kept saying, when am I going home? And there was clearly nothing else was going to be done in the hospital. It would be messy if he went home, possibly. But what I was interested to note was that each person, each doctor, for example, one doctor said, but John, he has infections. He'll give infections to everybody that's around him. And I said, everybody that's going to be around him is in the room with him right now, and no one's wearing a mask. So that clearly he was really saying, I'm scared. Help me make a decision I don't want to make. Another doctor said he should stay here because of if he dies, it's going to be a painful death. And I said, why will it be any less painful here than it would be at home? Why shouldn't he go on home where they can at least be in his own setting? Now, it is clear that he will not get the kind of nursing care that he would get at the hospital. But it's interesting. I called the family just before I came to the studio. And the mother said, well, you know, he's rested last night for the first night. It's much better than he's rested any night in the hospital, and he didn't have to have any of the medication. And he slept. And today he wanted to sit up. And he wasn't controlling his bowels or his bladder in the hospital, and he's now controlling both his bowels and his bladder. And he talks much more lucidly. Now, that's healthy. And I guess what really concerns me is that when we place people in artificial environments where sickness is the rule and where sickness is rewarded, we're going to get what we want. We're going to get what we program people to be. And that what we really need, and it gets back to the issue we started at the very beginning, whether it's for old people or for young people, we need environments which are health-giving environments among people who are supportive, caring people. And it just can't happen in our present healthcare system, which is designed for acute care, which is designed for intensive care, which is designed for something very different. Now, in terms of nursing homes in particular, and nursing homes for dying persons, I've had the opportunity, one of my other interests is working with dying people generally, and I chair the International Work Group on Death, Dying, and Bereavement, and have visited a half dozen or so hospices around England and around here. And when you go to a place like St. Christopher's Hospice in London, which is a place where 100 people are dying, it is a much cheerier place than any acute care hospital that you'll ever walk into in this country or in England. And people are not getting IVs, and they're not being intensively treated. They're being treated like human beings, and it's a totally healthy environment. And the needs of the person are being taken into account. Now, there are moves afoot in Philadelphia that I know of for at least 5 hospices that will be in the process of being set up at various parts of the city. And these will all be hopefully modeled on the English hospice, where a person can be comfortable and be cared for in those last months, years, weeks of life. We already have 2 places, one I know quite well personally, which is the Sacred Heart Home for Incurable Cancer, where these marvelous nuns work with only people who have incurable cancer. And although it's not quite up to the hospice standards, certainly it's an excellent, excellent place. And I think we really have to change our attitudes and feelings about care of people who are in their last months and years, and care about the way we feel about old people and the kind of environment you want them to have.
We've done a lot with the nursing home field, seeking to reform it. For the past 5 years, we've been investigating and reporting and blowing the whistle on abuses and neglect. We've seen some improvement. We have now protection against fire and other kinds of dangers. We've improved the physical conditions in which nursing home patients live. But it is an institution. And as Dr. Fryer says, you have taken people out of the usual environment. And the nursing home, by and large, is not a hospital, but it's used the hospital as its model. And people are treated as though they were in the hospital with less care. Now, we are concerned, and we're continuing to monitor nursing homes and working in different parts of the country for their improvement. We want the quality of life to be the goal and the maximum opportunity for people to live as fully as they can, even though, and this means much more involvement on the part of the community. It means a consistent group of concerned citizens who will visit, who will work with the staff and with the residents, and who will go back to the thing that John has said again and again, that affirm the right of that resident to decide how he or she will live and how he or she will be cared for.